Welcome to a special Labor Day episode of Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. For better or worse, like it or loathe it, beef and the American beef industry have shaped the landscape and history and taste buds of America. And much of that beef is consumed on Labor Day in the form of steaks and hamburgers. And if you don't cook hamburgers on your very own backyard grill, well, maybe you'd be grabbing a burger at one of the many fast food iconic restaurants. One of the most celebrated television commercials of all time debuted in 1984 with a catchphrase from a certain woman in a state of, well, you could say constant wonder, or more accurately, a state of perpetual perplexity. Do you remember the name Clara Peller?
Where's the beef?
It was an unrelenting question, and yeah, was it constant wonder? No, it was more like suffering from hives that just won't go away. It was a rash. It was urgent.
Where's the beef?
And for all the attention that the restaurant chain Wendy's received in that phenomenally successful marketing campaign, I'm actually a bit more fond of this next radio promotional spot because it really reflects more accurately just how fundamental beef has become as a commodity that we expect to find fresh and juicy anytime we go to the supermarket.
Beef stroganoff, beef bourguignon, Irish beef stew, beef brisket, Chateaubriand, sauerbraten, roast beef, Catalonian beef ragu, Mongolian beef, chicken fried steak, steak Diane, grilled steaks balsamico, hamburgers, sizzling beef, spicy braised beef, barbecued beef ribs, beef Wellington, pepper beef, beef jerky, beef with broccoli, beef burritos, beef fajitas, beef tacos. Do you see where I'm going with this? Beef. It's what's for dinner.
Oh, I do hope you remember that. And if you're salivating, I'm not going to, you know, accept blame for that. The permutations of beef, once they arrive on the American table, are truly staggering in number. Beef is just a cultural given. And Clara Peller's question, where's the beef, was ably answered there by Sam Elliott in the radio spot. Beef is everywhere. You can't get away from it. It just won't go away. And I guess maybe the big question is, how did it come in the first place? Why are we all eating it? How long have we been eating it in the quantities that we now eat it? Who decided, if anyone, that beef should become a staple, a pillar of our alimentation, you know? If data can be trusted, Americans eat on average 3 burgers a week, which comes to over 50 billion burgers every year, and that's just the beef that gets ground up. Not all those other delectable things that Sam Elliott mentioned. Well, also, if you want to learn where America might be going in the future with its pattern of beef consumption, the established pattern, might be good to understand where we've been and how we got here. And the story stretches far back into the 1800s. It includes tales of battles with Indians over territory, campfires with cowboys, the railroad, the meatpackers of Chicago. Eric Schulzke was mentioning them just a moment ago. Fierce political struggles, all kinds of consumer interest and activism as well, both for and against beef. Our guest now on Constant Wonder is Joshua Specht. He's author of Red Meat Republic, a hoof-to-table history of how beef changed America. Specht is currently on the faculty at the University of Notre Dame. He's an environmental and business historian specializing in the 19th century United States. Joshua Specht, welcome to our program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
You know, it seems like high-quality fresh beef available at every supermarket has become such a given, along with the idea that we should be able to purchase it and use it for almost any meal, every meal if you want. Is it even possible to back away from that assumption and view this situation as unusual or odd or strange?
Well, I think it's tough. I mean, as you've suggested, we take it for granted. And maybe to appreciate that, we have to think back to the 1870s and 1880s in the United States when there were all sorts of debates about the abundance of beef. So you had workers talking about how important it was as a measure of their success. And you had rich Americans expressing anxiety that poor Americans expected fancy cuts of meat. And so my book is trying to understand kind of how we got there and really answer historically the question of where's the beef.
You know, I am just, I want to say amused, but I'm also amused slash disturbed by something you just said, that the wealthy were resenting the poor for wanting fancy cuts of beef.
For sure. And I think that was a really strange part of my story, is what you see at the same time. So my book starts in 1865, when fresh beef was a kind of delicacy, and ends in 1906, when it's kind of daily fare. And that's the exact moment you see wealthier Americans starting to ask kind of social scientific questions about the diets of poor and working class Americans. And they're starting to say, well, look at these people in their imagination in China, maybe, who live off rice, and think of how cheaply they live, whereas these poor Americans are spending all of their money on beef. And so they start to study these things and ask questions. At the same time, workers are really insisting on having these fancy cuts of meat.
And I have so many of my own questions, too. The one I think I have to go to next would be to kind of go to where you begin the story. It seems like in order to have beef, you have to have land. And if you need land, sometimes you're going to have to take it away from Indians.
Yeah. I mean, there's a simple version of my story, which is to say, how do we get to this beef system? And that's, we have land, railroads to move things quickly, and you have refrigeration to keep meat.
That's the whole book in a nutshell right there.
Exactly. And American Indians seizing generally violently American Indian land was key to this story. And what I found is a much bigger picture about American expansion in the American West. And I see that cattle ranching was not just a tool for taking American Indian land, for occupying it, but also a justification for, because people imagined they were putting land to a higher use than perhaps American Indians had while hunting things like the bison.
Who was thinking this through from a values perspective? Who are these people thinking we can put the land to better use? It's not the cowboys thinking this, I don't think.
No, it's a variety of actors. You get early merchants going to the American West. You get buffalo hunters, or they were hunting bison. You get American officials, American military officials, and they're looking around and they're saying, well, we see all these bison. And we see all this land, and maybe we have these animals that look like this. Maybe we could do something with that. And then you get people moving there, and then after the fact, they're kind of justifying what has happened, because there is some anxiety about an awareness that this is maybe not entirely on the level, but they come up with this justification kind of after the fact.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Red River War? That goes back to 1874, 75. What was the dynamic there? Why did it happen?
Well, I use the Red River War to think about the relationship between warfare, violence, and the rise of cattle ranching. And so what you have is, this is an area mostly in the Texas Panhandle, and it connects the hunt of the bison with the rise of ranching. So you have early kind of hunters of bison moving into the region, and American Indians start to say, an alliance of a few different groups, the Kiowa, the Comanche, the Cheyenne, start to say, you know, these people are going to kill our means of subsistence and take our land. We need to fight back. And it starts a conflict between this alliance of American Indians and these hunters. And eventually the U.S. military decides, no, we have to solve this problem. We have to definitively gain control of this region. They fight back. They quickly crush this alliance. And just a few years later, Charles Goodnight, the famed rancher who's kind of immortalized in fiction in Lonesome Dove, founds his famous ranch near the site of that war's decisive battle.
I'm trying to imagine this entire stretch of time in the late 1800s as these things develop. And if the government gets involved in the war with indigenous peoples to displace them, to take over territory, nominally I'm thinking it's to preserve the peace. But I can't help wonder if people weren't lobbying Washington saying, we need that land.
No, I think that's right. One way to think about it is that often they want to preserve the peace. Imagine you're just a military or government official out west in the period. What you actually want is to avoid any kind of conflict, because it makes your job harder. But all of your assumptions about what is right or what is a good way to live are exactly the same as the Americans who are entering into conflict with the American Indians. So even though you might want to avoid conflict, you're always going to end up siding with the people who are trying to take this land for ranching or commercial bison hunting. And so that set of assumptions, along with the actors who kind of wanted that land already the whole time, is what produces this kind of piecemeal but big picture seizing of vast quantities of American Indian land.
You know, this is before the homesteading time, and your story begins a couple decades before that. I'm just wondering, you know, I have this mental image in my mind of the movement west, the European populations, pioneers, they're turning the sod and planting grain. And I'm just wondering, proportionately, how much of this westward movement was fueled by the meat industry rather than people wanted to move west and have farms?
Ah, that's a fascinating question. Well, I think one way to think about it is that this happens in kind of stages. And so often by the 1870s and 1880s, you actually see cattle ranchers and farmers, homesteaders coming into violent conflict over land. But the kind of first step of appropriating and using a lot of these dry Western lands, that was cattle ranching. And only then do you start to get farmers really moving into the area. And so you have Americans in the 19th century writing about these kind of stages of development of the West all the time. And I think a big part of that initial taking of land and using it, that was driven by the beef industry. You know, it wasn't shaped by the Chicago meatpackers directly, but the fact that there were these markets for cattle helped motivate people to get into these areas.
We're speaking with Joshua Specht. He's author of Red Meat Republic, A Hoof-to-Table History of How Beef Changed America. I'm Marcus Smith, and you're listening to a special Labor Day episode of Constant Wonder. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about the disassembly line in the Chicago meatpacking plants, which apparently inspired the assembly line of Henry Ford. Stay tuned. Joshua Specht is with us. He is author of Red Meat Republic. Just before the break, Joshua Specht, I was about to ask you a question that I could probably put this way. Nowadays, we think of big ag. We think of these vast acreages of huge, huge, mega-sized farms. I'm wondering if, as the meat, the cattle ranching industry out there in the West got going, if there was anything comparable to that. I think it started with smaller ranches, but then at some point, the big outfits tried to get involved.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have it right. We started this conversation and we were talking about relatively small-scale ranching, people who might only have a few dozen cattle. But what is an interesting kind of chapter of the story is that in the 1880s, once the kind of supremacy of the United States in some of these regions was secured, you get this influx of huge amounts of capital in these vast corporate ranches that get set up. It attracts money from as far away as the east coast of the United States and Scotland. And whereas you might have had, you know, herds of several hundred animals or maybe 1,000, now you get these 100,000 animal herds. So you get the famous Matador Ranch, which from 1882 was owned by Scottish investors. In Texas, you get the XIT Ranch, which has 3 million acres. And so they try to kind of make ranching into big business. Now, what's funny for the story is that they get a little too excited, and this leads to a kind of investment boom and a bust. And actually, many of them go bankrupt at the same time that the Chicago meatpackers are getting going, and they end up taking over the whole story from Chicago. But they did try this kind of big corporate ranching in the 1880s.
So it turns out to be the slaughterhouses in Chicago, those big bosses who end up setting all the rules for the beef industry?
Exactly. So they end up kind of, they said at the time that everyone danced to Philip Armour's tune. And Armour was the head of Armour & Company, the biggest of these four Chicago meatpacking firms. So just as ranching is taking off in the West, and just as there's this boom in cattle ranching, once that turns to bust, there's still lots and lots of cattle there that are coming into Chicago. And these big Chicago firms move very quickly, within just a decade or so, around the 1880s, from being local players to national and then global actors. And they become so powerful that they can dictate the prices ranchers get, and they can also dictate prices almost to consumers.
And the story gets very nasty, because this is the Gilded Age, and this is not the age in which the small people have a hard time speaking truth to power, and you get Upton Sinclair, you get the jungle, you get all sorts of problems of exploitation of the people, not to say anything about violence towards the animals, and I'm speaking as one who had a pastrami burger yesterday. This is a terrible time.
Yeah, I mean, I think your use of the word nasty is appropriate because, first of all, there's sanitation questions that come up. But yeah, this is a human struggle. So one thing I talk about is the kind of genius, in a way, of the slaughterhouse in Chicago, where they pioneer what they call the disassembly line, but Henry Ford says it inspires his idea later for the assembly line. So they come up with this way to take apart an animal by specializing all the tasks.
And while that's kind of brilliant how you break it into little steps, it actually enables you to exploit people to a far greater degree. So we see this kind of using up of workers in very dangerous, poorly paid conditions, and we see bloody fights over unionization and kind of power on the slaughterhouse floor.
The workers became pretty expendable, didn't they?
Yeah, I tell the story of a boy named Vincenzo Rakowski. He's born in Eastern Europe, and at the age of 14, he's working in a slaughterhouse trimming cattle carcasses, and he's actually injured. He's struck by a side of beef and cuts himself badly with his knife and has basically a lifelong injury and spends the rest of his life trying to get some kind of compensation. But the courts largely side with the meatpackers because, in a way, the whole legal system is set up to privilege these kind of big, powerful businesses at the time.
No inklings of unionization at this point?
Well, they're trying. So by the early 20th century, they eventually secure some meatpacking workers' unions. But the Chicago meatpackers in the 1880s are very hostile. So I tell the story of one strike in the mid-1880s that is essentially crushed. And that's in part because the people in power in Chicago, the government actors, are also willing to support, to side with the big meatpackers. So there's fights over unionization, but they're not successful until after 1900.
When you tell these stories of what happened to the exploited workers in the slaughterhouses, that story is well known. It goes back for a long time. The muckraking of Sinclair was very important. I always kind of grew up with the idea, and I don't know how this happened in my school textbooks, but I just thought it was all about safe meat to eat. Yes, we talked about the exploitation of the workers, but for some reason we gravitate towards those issues of hygiene and proper distribution and refrigeration, and are there mice there? Is there a reason that someone like me would gravitate to remembering that story over the human story, the human cost?
Well, I think there's a very good reason, which is if you think about your, I think you said pastrami sandwich you had for lunch, if you were worried that was going to poison you, you know, would you be more worried about that, or would you be more worried about the workers? And so there's a kind of visceral reaction to the possibility that our food is contaminated. Now, what was interesting about Upton Sinclair in the jungle, this is in 1906, is he had a revolutionary message. He wanted to kind of foment the socialist revolution in the U.S. But he often said that he aimed for the public's heart, and people, he hit them in the stomach. And so he wanted to liberate the workers, but he also wanted to raise questions about sanitation. And everybody remembers the sanitation. And part of that is because dealing with sanitary issues serves the interests of the big meatpackers, right? They don't want you worried about what you're eating. So that creates a problem they can solve. They can make their meat sanitary and safe. Now, there obviously are questions today about regulating and inspection, but largely the meat industry wants their food to be safe to eat. And so they can solve that while kind of sweeping under the rug the issues of labor or environmental impact.
Now, I have raced ahead to hear the story of the slaughterhouses in Chicago and to understand the power base there of the people running the operations. They're the kingpins. I want to go back, though, out onto the Texas stretches of the ranch lands where the cowboys are. What happens to the cowboys in this? It sounds like they are not much better off than the poor 14-year-old boy you talked about.
Yeah, I mean, this is one thing that surprised me was I was reading a lot about the stories of the cowboys and trying to understand what their work was like and realizing that they're also kind of laborers in a way that we don't immediately think of, right? We have this romantic idea, but they're paid a wage. They're often poor. They're often overworked. It is a bit different than the slaughterhouse worker because when I look at the story, I look at one cowboy who worked in New Mexico, a guy named Way Hamlin Updegraff. Kind of a funny name. And he was both kind of working hard and felt a little bit exploited, but he also saw tremendous kind of value and identity in his work on a cattle ranch. So I try to think about how do we understand both work that's very meaningful to people and yet it's somewhat exploited. And so there was even a cowboy strike in the 1880s. But all of this was important to making the whole system run.
You know, this exploitation thing, the story of the cowboys, I just have to say that, well, I'll put it this way. Not only did I eat a pastrami burger yesterday, But my wife's great-great-great-great-great-grandfather wrote Home on the Range, the lyrics for it. And I think about that Home on the Range and the myth of the idyllic kind of conditions and your longing, pining away for that beautiful time back when never was heard a discouraging word. Somebody got involved and told that story, and I don't know if it was the cowboys themselves.
Yeah, I mean, that story is important. Well, if you think about that story, that kind of serves everyone's interests in a way. I mean, part of that story is suggesting that the kind of greater American West was an empty space devoid of people ready to be settled. So that's helping justify the kind of land taking that had happened and violence. There's a story that this is orderly, and there's a story that this is connected deeply to what it means to be American. And that helps get people eating beef. That helps get people romanticizing the cowboy and cattle ranching, which works well for cattle ranchers. It's kind of a feel-good story that's win-win if you're trying to sell hamburgers. And it's the place of the historian to say, well, you know, hang on a minute. There's something to that, but there's a lot more to the story.
So were the big power brokers, were they involved in any kind of marketing or campaign to paint the picture rosy?
To some extent. I mean, I think of it more as they kind of overlapped with some broader kind of cultural forces around the place of the American West and a fascination from the public. But they were definitely promoting that. I mean, generally, the meatpackers didn't engage in too much direct marketing. But when they did on products like canned beef, they would show idyllic Western scenes, right? They're not going to put an image of the slaughterhouse on the side of their can. They're going to show some cowboys riding around some vast spaces. And so they did kind of perpetuate and benefit from that, for sure.
I want to go now to what drives all of this, and I tend to think it's kind of like supply and demand. And the demand part of the story, you get into that with consumers, where even I think it was in New York City there was violence. A group of women you talk about in 1902. Tell us that story.
Ah, okay. So I tell the story near the end of the book of a meat riot. So one thing we like to think about maybe when we've got our, you know, historian hat on, or we're not thinking about our own food but someone else's food, is we tend to think like calories are all sort of the same. Like, oh, why don't people just eat whatever? And I tell the story in the early 20th century of a time when meat prices skyrocketed and people couldn't afford it, or people stopped selling beef. And rather than eating, you know, fish or chicken or even worse, a potato, people decided to riot. They attacked the butcher shops that they thought were fleecing them. They took meat out of people's hands and threw it on the ground and stomped on it. They poured acid on it. And in a way, it was a kind of protest. And in that protest, they were saying that who we are as people and the kind of meaning we make in our lives depends on us having this kind of Chicago meat, well, meat in general.
So our identity, our self-definition that is rooted to sort of a right to beef, in a way, goes clear back to a riot in 1902 where women stormed the butcher shops. I mean, at that point, like the premise of civilization is that we will eat red meat come hell or high water.
Yeah. I mean, I look at a labor movement pamphlet from the 19th century, and it makes the argument that beef is essential to American manhood and civilization. Workers must have beef to kind of be successful. And throughout the book, to be successful for Americans is to eat beef, and that shapes all of the story I tell.
Now, I'm going to bring up the biggest possible context of all without going to the moon or Mars. And I don't know if this is within the scope of your book, but there are other beef countries. I'm thinking of Australia. I'm thinking of Argentina. Is there a definition there that you could even comment on where other societies, other cultures feel that beef is utterly essential?
Yeah, well, I think one thing I trace at the end of my story. So first of all, those places have a lot of parallels. What happens in Argentina, what happens in Australia. I think the U.S. takes it to an extreme where low prices to the consumer shape all of this industry. And so the U.S. is not fundamentally different, but it is extreme. But what I've been thinking about since I wrote the book, because my book stops in the early 20th century, is that the story of the 20th century to now is actually the globalization of this American beef model all around the world. So if in the end of my story, to be successful in the United States is to eat beef, today and throughout the 20th century as well, to be successful globally was to eat beef. And this is why you see the rising middle class around the world eating more and more meat and often beef. And that has huge impacts around the world. And we see it currently with what's happening in Brazil with deforestation in the Amazon for livestock production.
And this is where we have to try to tie a bow around a conversation that can't have a bow at all, because it's just this is enormous story. I just want to know if at the end of having written this book, where you're looking backward, if your assessment is that the momentum, the cultural, societal momentum that depends on beef, or think we depend on beef, if that is so enormous that it, you know that metaphor of the ship, you try to turn it and you have to crank the rudder real hard and it takes I don't know how many knots before the ship turns. Can you describe that momentum and where you would say we're headed?
Well, it's going to take a long time. I mean, one of my insights is that our taste preferences and our food is very deep in who we are. We can't just overnight change it. I think the evidence suggests in the long term we're going to have to change the place of beef in our kind of food map. We're going to have to eat less, maybe abandon it altogether. But in the meantime, I think we're going to have to think about producing our beef slightly differently, and that might make beef a bit more expensive to mitigate the environmental impacts, to have better labor conditions. And so we also have to think more generally about how to make better produced food more affordable for all Americans and all people. And so it's certainly a big kind of set of changes. And it's possible, but you're right, it's going to take a long time.
And ultimately, is it or is it not kind of cynical to think that our human perceived needs that inform what our economy is going to be built on, those perceptions are so important that they will fundamentally determine whatever it is we're going to eat and how we're going to get that food?
That is a big question. I mean, I think there's a lot to that. And I think kind of meeting people where they are and their worldview is important for understanding how human society is, but also how it can change in the future. And I think we have to think about that with food and beef.
Joshua Specht with us there. He's an environmental and business historian at Notre Dame. His book is titled Red Meat Republic, a hoof-to-table history of how beef changed America. The volume explores how the American rich and poor came to expect affordable, high-quality, fresh beef. And, of course, he talks about the human and environmental costs. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is a special Labor Day edition of Constant Wonder, focusing on the American beef industry. And when we come back after a break, we're going to consider the end game of much of that beef production. We're going to be looking at the greatest regional hamburgers. Do you know what a slider is? Technically, I mean. Pretty good odds are that you could be wrong on this point. I was. We'll be right back with more Constant Wonder. Stay tuned. Thanks for joining with us for Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Come back in time with me to a quaint little fast food grill of the early 80s. Actually, it may have been around a lot longer than that, but my first encounter, with a hamburger joint called Crown Burger came circa 1980, maybe 1981. It just so happens that Crown Burger, this establishment, sits immediately adjacent to one of the earliest Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise restaurants in the country. This is in Salt Lake City, by the way, although Kentucky Fried Chicken was not originally a Utah thing. It's Kentucky Fried Chicken. But neither is pastrami really a Utah thing to begin with. But they have them at Crown Burger. So back to my story. A friend from California, a high school buddy I'd grown up with, he came up to visit me here in Salt Lake City. We're from San Diego. We're both at this Crown Burger place in the Intermountain West. We're new here, and I am pretty much new to pastrami. I maybe had tasted the stuff a month or two before. And we're ordering our burgers. I say, you got to try the pastrami. And then he ordered on my recommendation, and we sat down. And he picks up this mustard container and starts squeezing mustard all over it. And he didn't know about fry sauce, because you don't mix the fry sauce with the mustard, in my humble estimation, even if you're new to pastrami. And he should have tasted the burger first and then maybe applied the mustard. That's just my view. We all, there's no accounting for taste. And there is accounting for ignorance. I was new to this cuisine myself. Well, here on Constant Wonder, we're now going to explore the vast range of different styles and tastes that inform burger consumption all across America. Apparently, there are vast regional differences. And many of these differences can become, a point of pride for local connoisseurs, or they can become the focus of an expert like our next guest. who has made connoisseurship with hamburgers something of a life purpose. Get ready for this grand survey of what's available hot off the grill all across the country. America's hamburger expert and author, George Motes, is with us. Motes is a well-traveled, Emmy Award-winning freelance filmmaker based in New York City. In 2005, he completed Hamburger America, a documentary. And now I understand there is a state-to-state guide to hamburgers, also titled Hamburger America. That's been out for a bit. George Motes on the line with us. Welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thanks for having me on.
George Motes, if there is such a thing as a burger connoisseur, there's also such a thing, I'm sure, as a burger bumpkin. That's me, and you're talking to me right now. Is there any hope for me? Do I have to go out? do I have to go exploring to understand all of this?
Of course you do. Or you can just read my books, which are very informative, very definitive. I shouldn't say very definitive because, you know, people ask me all the time, do you know everything about every burger in America? No, of course I don't. There's way too many, way too many food ways out there and burger ways for me to know everything. That's for sure. But I do know a lot. I know more than most people.
Well, that puts you in a good line of work where you'll always have something to do.
And by the way, you were off by a few years with your Crown Burger assessment. 1984 was about 5 years after Crown Burger opened, just so you know.
Crown Burger opened? you know when Crown Burger opened?
Yeah, 1979.
So I got there just 2 years afterwards. That's pretty good for a bumpkin like me.
Well, that's pretty good, yeah.
Let's talk about how you got into this. Did you just wake up one morning and say, burgers will now be my life?
No, it was actually a bit of an accident. It was a mistake, a happy accident, I'll say. About 20 years ago, I was looking for a documentary film subject. And a friend of mine had recommended doing some sort of food subject. At the same time, the Food Network was looking for content. And I decided to make a very short piece about a single hamburger spot in New Mexico. And while I was interviewing him, I said, this is really an amazing interview. I thought it was going to be some silly little short, you know, segment for Food Network with not a whole lot of depth, and ended up being very deep. I decided to go out and find more stories and string them all together in a film called Hamburger America. And no one had ever done that before.
Yeah, and this means that in order to do this, it can't just be all abstract and theoretical. You got to get some empirical evidence, and that means you're going to be biting into these burgers.
Oh, of course. I mean, people ask me all the time, do you eat all these burgers that you talk about and that you put in your books? Well, of course. I mean, if you look at my books, every single burger you see in the book that is photographed is actually my photograph of the burger that I ate, or at least I'd say one of the burgers that I ate.
Have you counted them? Is there a tally?
You know, there is. I like to say that I'm up to probably somewhere between 12 to 13,000 burgers in the last 20 years, 18 years or so.
How many per day is that?
It's roughly, I think we figured out it was roughly one a day, but or more than one a day sometimes. But in some cases, I'll have, you know, very small burgers, or I'll eat five in a day, or I'll eat 10 burgers in one day. Sometimes I'll have no burgers for a week. So it really depends.
I'm just trusting you're never committed to the whole burger.
That's funny. I've gotten a little bit older. So I actually I've been asked by my doctors, plural, to dial back a little bit. And I'm now not finishing burgers only because I just want to make sure I can enjoy the next burger one day. So I am up until about a year ago, I was eating the entire burger. But recently, because I do so much burger eating, I've decided to cut back just a little bit. But still, as far as I'm concerned, when you eat a burger, the first bite should be the best bite, or one of the best bites. And that's how you know it's a great burger. So really, if you're having a few bites of a burger, you're getting the entire picture.
Now, we're going to get into the very technical nuances of all of this. I want to begin with the concept of classic. Is there such a thing as a classic American hamburger?
Yes. And the classic American burger, unfortunately, I think a lot of people have a preconceived notion that it's a backyard burger, which is not true at all. It's also, people have this preconceived notion that it's a big burger, that it's big triple patty with, you know, sesame seed bun and, you know, invented by a big chain called McDonald's or Burger King. This is not true at all. The classic American hamburger predates all those notions. In fact, it goes all the way back to the turn of the century. And the true burger was created. The true American burger would have been something invented or created around 19 or popularized in 1920 at places like White Castle, White Tower, White Hut. These very small restaurants that were all called White. And this is the classic burger was a very small burger. In fact, it's also what we know today as the slider, which is it's another designation that gets confused a lot. But the original burger, I would say, is probably unquestionably the slider, which is a very small 1 ounce patty smashed on a flat top, usually served with some fried onions.
So the slider isn't a little mini hamburger at all?
Right. Somewhere out there, if you Google it, I have a great diatribe against the the mini burger. There's been a crazy misunderstanding about what is a slider and what is a mini burger. They're two very different things. I mean, the short story is that a mini burger is literally a scaled down version of a large burger. So whatever that burger is, whatever those toppings are, it's just a smaller version of that. Usually they're very, very, they're not very satisfying. They're usually a big letdown. The slider is actually based not on size, but on method. By virtue of its size, it is a mini burger. But it's because of its method, which is basically a ball of beef, fresh beef that has been smashed thin on the flat top, cooked fast with some onions, and served with nothing more than maybe mustard and a pickle on a very small bun. That is a slider, and there's no other definition for it.
Well, this is so interesting because you can use the word lean to talk about, you know, the grease content, but you could also say that's very lean just in terms of few ingredients.
This is true. It is definitely lean on ingredients, but what I like to say is that the sum is far greater than its parts. Because when you bite into this thing, the first thing anybody asks me when I make this burger for someone, I do this a lot, they say, "What's your sauce? What's your secret? What's the spice? What's going on here?" And I have to tell them, no, nothing. It's literally, there's five ingredients in there usually, which is bun, beef, cheese, onion, and salt, and that's it. And for some reason, people think I have a sauce on there. I said, no, actually, I consider grease to be a condiment. if you have good beef grease, it's a condiment.
Grease as a condiment. I'm going to have to chew on that one for a long time here. I just want to know if less is more, kind of is what you're saying, that when you have these fancy burgers where they pile in all kinds of, you know, you get the blue cheese that, and you get the teriyaki this, and they keep doing new variations by kind of gussying it up all around the edges. That doesn't appeal to you so much.
I mean, no, it doesn't. I mean, I'm a bit of a purist. I'm actually more than just a bit. I am a purist, period. When it comes to hamburgers, I don't mind people taking, you know, the poetic license with the burger patty and having fun with it. To me, I would tell people that you need to be able to taste the beef, because if you really have great beef, and the rendered beef fat is really where the flavor is. You want to be able to taste that. If you can't taste that, then you might as well be making some kind of sandwich. I'd rather call it a sandwich. It was loaded up with, you know, bits of, like, you know, mushroom and shrimp and whatever else. It's no longer a hamburger. It's just a vehicle for, you know, somebody's sandwich.
We're going to go a little touring here in just a little bit. But first I want to go back to just the word hamburger. I'm a word guy. Hamburger, there's this, you know, place, Hamburg in Germany, right?
That's right.
Do you know anything about the derivation of the word, or if it has any connection to that city?
It actually does. There's a very interesting historical connection to that city, because as Germans were trying to find passage to America, they had to leave from Germany out of the port of Hamburg. And when they went to Hamburg, sometimes they couldn't get passage on a ship, so they had to wait for a long time. It was a very inexpensive chop steak. It was cooked somehow and served on a plate with some onions, probably potatoes. And that was a very inexpensive way to get a serious boost of protein before you got on a ship. And then the Germans would arrive in America. They'd come through New York, and they'd find all the Germans that had preceded them were now selling that same thing in lower Manhattan. And they were calling it Hamburg steak, well, Hamburg. And that's how it started. And as people started to migrate west into the Midwest, especially, state fairs became a thing at that exact moment. So as the Germans were immigrating and then now migrating west, they were stopping in the Midwest, creating state fairs, eating Hamburg steak on a plate. And it was somewhere in the Midwest that somebody saw a hot dog walk by, I'm sure, at a state fair. And they said, that's portable. Why can't we make our Hamburg steak, which is served with a knife and a fork on a plate? Well, we should be able to make that portable. And then the hamburger was born.
Well, the reason your story holds water for me is because I happen to know that Hamburg in Germany, that really was a major port for people leaving, the immigrants coming, the docks and ships. And so that makes sense that this cuisine originates there. Have you been able to pinpoint where the first hamburgers that could be called original hamburgers were sold you know, at some restaurant in America? Or maybe people are just claiming to be the first.
There are a lot of claims. There are many claims. One of them is Delmonico's. Delmonico's has a Hamburg steak in the menu, but then we just found out that the date on the menu was actually forged. So all this history about Delmonico's having the first Hamburg steak on the menu and charging 15 cents a plate, it's all been debunked, unfortunately. The actual Hamburg sandwich, which is the first one was called, or known as a hamburger, which is also, by the way, somebody who's from Hamburg is a hamburger, by the way, if you knew that. that's their actual name. But the hamburger or the Hamburg sandwich in America was likely invented in Texas, Wisconsin. There's a claim in Missouri, Kansas, Ohio. It's all over the Midwest, a lot of parts of the Midwest. One even in New York State. Hamburg, New York has one, which is they've all been proven somewhat wrong. They can't quite nail down any of the details. The oldest continually operating hamburger restaurant in America is a place called Louie's Lunch in New Haven, Connecticut. And they have the strongest claim, but their claim, unfortunately, is not until 1900. They're probably about 15 years after some of the first reports of the Hamburg steak being served on bread.
Let's talk about the Cuban Frita hamburger, the Juicy Lucy, the Slug Burger. Some of your favorite, I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to say favorites. Some of them that you like a lot. What is the Juicy Lucy?
Juicy Lucy is funny. It only exists, as far as I know, in Minneapolis and St. Paul. I shouldn't say Minneapolis. In the Twin Cities, in both cities. It's a very basic burger. It's actually more of a science project than anything else. because there's two thin patties that are pinched together, and inside is a folded slice of American cheese. Or any kind of cheese. A lot of restaurants now try to experiment with different cheeses. You can have blue cheese, cheddar, and all this kind of stuff in there, pepper jack. But the original was obviously made with American cheese. And what's the reason it's a science experiment is if you don't make it correctly, it will explode on the flat top because all that pressure builds up inside.
You're not being hyperbolic there. It would actually go kapow.
It actually will go. In fact, a friend of mine tried to recreate this in his restaurant 2 years ago, and he came running out into the dining room saying, "George, help, help, help." And I walked into the kitchen. There was cheese everywhere. And so I said, "Well, I know what you're doing wrong. You need to find a pin and create a little pin prick just in the top of the burger when you flip it, and that lets off just enough steam that the thing won't explode." And that one little piece of information saved the day. And in fact, it's the one thing that all these guys do when they make the Juicy Lucy is they do a tiny little pin prick to make sure it doesn't explode.
And so when it's ready for consumption, it's pretty piping hot.
It's the only burger I know that comes with a warning. They say, whatever you do, don't just put this thing in your mouth. It's going to burn your face off. So they make sure that you nibble around the edges. A little old lady once told me, nibble around the edges and slowly get in there. Eventually, you'll get to the cheese. Otherwise, you will have a problem. My first Juicy Lucy I ate was all over my chin and burned my face.
Okay, for the intrepid. How about this thing from Cuba, or if it is really from Cuba, a Cuban hamburger?
Yes, it's called the Cuban Frita. And what's really crazy about this burger is that it exists in Miami. Pretty much doesn't exist anywhere else in the form that exists in Miami, anywhere else in the country or the world, as far as I know. I've only seen it in Miami. I've really only had the best ones in Miami, and specifically Little Havana, but where most of them are concentrated. What's really even crazier about this burger is that it doesn't even exist in Cuba anymore because all the ingredients that are in this burger cannot be found in what was obviously the communist Cuba for over 50 years.
And those ingredients are?
Well, there's so many. that's why. I mean, even like the basics of like lettuce and onions, really it's hard to find these kinds of things in Cuba, I think even to this day, which is incredible. But I mean, it's basically, imagine it's a spiced patty where they actually take one of the only burgers I eat where I actually allow spices to go into the meat. But it's almost like they make some kind of almost like a beef sausage patty that gets pressed flat on a flat top. It gets squirted with some kind of like a hot sauce, almost like a watered down hot sauce, and it cooks and bubbles in this hot sauce for a few minutes. It gets it does not get cheese. It gets served on a round Cuban roll that's been fried a little bit. I've been toasted. And served with a big, big nest of basically thin fried julienne potatoes and ketchup and some more chopped onions. It's incredible. It's a really incredible burger. It almost has like a chorizo spices in it.
Well, this sounds like you're moving away from your position of being a purist.
This is true, but this is the one burger I do. To me, it is a pure expression of the Cuban American experience, and that's more important to me than anything.
So, a slug burger, not an appetizing name.
Right, but it was called a slug burger because back in the day, it was 5 cents, and that was where I got the name slug.
I get it. I see.
Yeah, no slugs in that one. The slug burger is a very specific burger. It exists today even only in northern Mississippi. And it's a very basic burger where you take yesterday's loaves of bread, you crush them up, make dry breadcrumbs, and you put them into the burger meat. And it actually extends the meat a little bit, but it also, there's some weird science going on there, where once you're frying up this burger, the rendered beef fat starts to seep into these bits of crumbs and fry the bread. And you end up with a very, very pronounced crunch and a very flavorful burger.
Well, that sounds fun. I'd go for that.
That's a good one.
Little pockets of joy tucked away inside the burger there. Let's move on. Where would I find a loose meat sandwich?
Loose meat sandwich, the center of the loose meats world is Iowa. I believe it's also, I forgot if it's an Iowa invention. It probably isn't an Iowa invention, but then it seeped out to every surrounding state around Iowa.
Seeped is a good verb there, yes. Go ahead.
Yeah. Seeped. But the loose meat sandwich is exactly that. It's not a burger. It's not a formed burger patty. They're steamed pebbled beef. In other words, it's almost like a sloppy Joe without the slop. Imagine like a crumbled beef served with a little bit of salt, and then it's served on a hamburger bun, but it's also served with a spoon. So if you do something falls out, you can always scoop it back up. It's a very strange sandwich, but the profile is very, very close to a hamburger. So that's why I include it in all my studies.
A smash burger. I've got my list here. You see, I'm ticking them off, and I'm wondering if a smash burger is. To me, it sounds like the technique you were talking about with sliders.
That's exactly right. So the smash burger really is the original American hamburger technique, and it was only done for speed, where short order chefs knew that they had a very short lunch hour, and a big line, and they had to find a way to serve everyone at the same time. Also, a lot of these guys would have very small stands with maybe four or five stools up front. You had to clear out those stools. The fastest way to do it was to smash it. Take a ball of beef and smash it flat on the flat top, and it would cook fast. The edges would get a little bit crunchy. You end up with what I like to call beef candy around the edges. I'm a lacy beef candy.
I'm good with beef candy. That sounds good.
If you combine beef candy with some salt and a pickle and mustard, you end up with one of the greatest smash burgers ever.
I know that you suspect I'm going to go to a couple of news zones here because it's all in the news these days. The Impossible Burger. Can I even say that and not make you get a little, you get your hackles up?
No, there's reasons why I get my hackles up. People don't really, are probably not ready for this answer. But to me, it's, people are, they're inventing a hamburger. Technically, it's not a beef burger. So that side says to me, that side appeals to, that part of it appeals to my burger side. Fine. They're trying to get people to eat burgers, whether it's beef or not. It's a burger. It's still a burger. The downside is that there are too many ingredients. If you take Impossible Burger, and there's 21 ingredients in that mix, the fake beef blend. It's one of the best impostors out there. It actually kind of tastes like a burger, but it actually kind of feels like a burger. And honestly, when it's raw, it kind of smells like a burger, which is even weirder to me. I don't know how they did that. But they did do it through chemicals, through too many ingredients. I mean, you look at a beef burger, and there's one ingredient. It's just ground beef. It's a natural product. It's ground up and it's cooked. It hasn't been messed with. I think it's actually, to never really add more than one other ingredient, which is salt to a patty, not 21 ingredients.
George, because you have said that grease is a condiment, I looked it up. That's kind of the thing. I'm always doing that. And I found out it means a spice or a sauce or a flavoring. Originally, it had to do with pickling things, but grease, you don't pickle things in grease usually. When did you first decide to start calling it a condiment?
Oh, when I saw that there were some burgers out there in America, especially in the Midwest, I've noticed, where there really was nothing else in the burger but maybe some cheese, maybe not even cheese, maybe some onions. And the grease was actually very present. It was still there. If the burger's cooked on a flat top, it's cooked in its own grease, almost as if you would sort of a confit, beef confit. and it's true, think about it. And that actually is what creates that flavor. And if you eliminate grease, you don't have enough fat in your burger, you're going to be shorting yourself one of the greatest flavors, I think, on earth.
Well, let's talk about this tallow versus lard business. Is that very scientific?
Sure. I mean, cooking is obviously science anyway. But definitely cooking in fat is definitely a sign.
And the distinction between tallow and lard?
Well, just a very straightforward definition. The tallow is rendered beef fat and lard is rendered pig fat, pork fat.
And both of them can burn. Because I think of tallow candles. Those, didn't they make candles out of those tapers?
They did. Yes, exactly. Yeah. It is a very, very high, low burning point. So it'll smoke fast, unfortunately. That's the downside of tallow. I mean, if you cook it at a low temperature, you can actually do some great things with tallow for sure.
So if I go to a burger joint and they're serving what they call a char burger, is it the grease that's burning? Is it the tallow?
Well, that's a great question. So no, a char burger is actually cooked over a flame. And what's happening is there's some crazy science going on there for sure, because when you put a hamburger patty on over flame, the grease renders, the fat renders from the hamburger and actually drips into the fire. Once the grease hits the fire, it actually ignites and it releases all these carbonic compounds that go up into the area where the burger's cooking and lands, you know, gently back on top of the burger again to create that smoky flavor. So that's really what's happening there. That's a different science.
Well, let's go to Memphis, Tennessee now, because I have mentioned it, and Dyer's Burgers. Have you been there lately?
Last time I was there was probably about 2 years ago, alive and well, doing great.
And they have quite a history, I understand, going back. Tell us about the age of this grease they cook with.
They started cooking with grease in the early part of the 19th century. 20th century, I'm sorry. That far back. but 1904, I believe it was. I don't have my year exactly in front of me right now. But it's been over 100 years since they've been making burgers cooked in deep fat.
Not quite colonial burgers.
No, not quite colonial burgers. But turn of the century. The turn of the century when hamburgers were just starting to become a thing. People were trying to find different ways to make burgers. And the great story with Dyer's is that what they would do is they would make burgers in a skillet. This is, of course, you know, in 1900, this, of course, predates any kind of flat top or any kind of, you know, outdoor flame grill, backyard grilling. Back then, you made a burger, you cooked it in a skillet, which had sides on it, obviously. And then when you cooked in a skillet and you cooked a burger, what happened was all that fat would render. The rendered fat would then stay inside the skillet. The more burgers you made, the deeper the fat would get. At some point, it would become a deep-fried burger. You're deep-frying your burgers in beef tallow. And if a guy was working in a restaurant, he's got orders coming in, order after order, there's no time to drain off the fat. People actually kind of liked the fact that it was deep-fried. It was adding a lot more flavor to the burger. So at that point, the deep-fried burger was born.
George Motes with us. He's author of the Great American Burger Book, How to Make Authentic Regional Hamburgers at Home. We're going to hear a little bit more from George Motes again in the coming hour here on Constant Wonder. You know, I was just so tickled by his suggestion that grease is a condiment, that after having this conversation, we had to have him back on our show to explore that again. I want to have a little bit of a chance for you to dip into this whole concept about grease and its value in our lives, if it comes from a burger. So we've got beef and burgers maybe all set for the Labor Day picnic. And in our next hour, we'll talk up condiments, mustard, vinegar, and grease, courtesy of Mr. Motes. We'll be right back with more Constant Wonder after the news.